Before we begin tonight, a couple of little housekeeping issues and maybe a personal note or two. I've struggled with my voice today. We'll see how long it lasts. Just a little bit hoarse. I don't know if it's the weather or what. I feel perfectly fine, but for some reason my voice is just a little bit hoarse. So you'll bear with me tonight. The other thing I'd like to say, and I haven't said this before, and I've kind of been meaning to and just hadn't found the time. So many of you have expressed words of encouragement to me during this quarter that I've taught. We still got a few more weeks to go, so maybe this is premature. But I appreciate that so much. And you don't really know how much that means to me to get your words of encouragement. Any of y'all that have stood here in this place and have taught this class know that at times it can be intimidating. At times, if you're the only one speaking and you're not getting a lot of participation, it can make it even more difficult. And you guys have not done that to me this quarter, and I certainly do appreciate it, and I do continue to solicit your feedback as I teach the rest of this class. Having said that, there are a few that have remarked to me that they wish those that participated would speak up just a little louder. And so I would encourage you that if you make a comment, try to speak up a little louder. There are some that maybe don't hear as well as others, and to make that where something that the whole class can hear, I will try. I haven't tried in times past to repeat some portion of it, but that can get a little tedious. So I'd ask that if you can, to please speak up. So when we left off on Sunday morning, God had just basically delivered the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai. And we had gotten through about verse 21, and I want to go ahead and finish out chapter 20 before we get into chapter 21, 22, and ever how far we get tonight. So there in verse 22 of chapter 20, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, You have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make anything to be with me gods of silver or gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and you shall sacrifice on it burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I record my name, I will come to you and I will bless you. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone. For if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar that your nakedness may be exposed on it." So just a few points I want to make on these final verses of chapter 20. The first is obviously the idea of nothing of gold or silver was to be made. God, and this becomes important a few chapters later when Moses spends several days up on the mountain and the golden calf is built. Aaron takes care of that. God had repeatedly warned them there was not to be any other gods. There were not to be hewn gods, you know, gods they had carved here, gods of gold or silver. They just weren't to have those. As I was thinking about that, the passage over in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 through 23 came to mind, where it says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and in their foolish hearts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things." And the idea I get when I read that, it really is that last verse there, the idea of changing the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man or something else that God has created here on this earth. It's not to be done. And you don't truly understand God if that's what you think and that's what you need in order to worship him. Passing comment about the idea of altars made of earth and stones that were not hewn. It's interesting to think about that in light of today, you know, all the elaborate things that are built to worship God and the glory and majesty that people want to put into that earthly glory and majesty. And how simple this was, an altar of earth or an altar of uncarved stone, basically, was what God was requesting here. And then the last point I wanted to make in this last passage of Scripture has to do with this last verse. And it says, nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it. And if you turn over just a couple more pages to chapter 28, you see a little more detail kind of on that same thought. And in chapter 28 and verse 42, it's talking about the priest, and it says, you shall make for them linen trousers to cover their nakedness, and they shall reach from their waist to their thighs. And, you know, when we started this quarter, we talked about the things that were written before time were written for our learning. And the idea of modesty. And the idea of modesty and God's demand for modesty has always been in his scriptures, going all the way back to here. And the idea that these trousers were to be something from the waist down to the thigh, it gives you an idea of God's standard. And just something to think about. Because, you know, it's a, well, that's in the old. I don't think God's standard of modesty has changed between the old covenant and the new covenant. And just something I'll throw out, something for you to think about. In the world we live in today, it's certainly something that I don't think we can emphasize enough. And John has preached several good lessons about modesty in the time that we've been here. And something that we need to take to heart, something we need to teach our children. So any questions or comments about chapter 20 before we move on tonight? I'm often, occasionally you hear people talk about worship and going to worship, and it becomes all about how it made them feel, how it impacted them with that. And typically when they talk like that, it's an emotional feeling that they're looking for. And somehow they equate that emotional feeling to that connection with God. And, you know, I don't think that our worship should be without emotion. But when we let emotion carry us and we consider that the most important thing, I think we miss the point. Questions, other questions or comments? If not, as we enter into chapter 21, the text changes somewhat. What we've dealt with primarily up through the first 20 chapters of this book has been kind of a narrative, a story. And this is part of the story, but the next couple, two or three chapters are really a lot of laws and God's laws for his people. And as I was jotting down notes, one of the things I wrote is these verses tell us a lot of the what But they don't always tell us the why. Sometimes they do. Sometimes God expresses his thought as to why it is this way. But a lot of these are just rules, and God tells us what he expects. I was reminded of the verse over in Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 8, where it says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord." And the reason that thought came to mind is sometimes when I read these rules, I think, well, you know, that's not what we see today, or that's not what we do today, or that's not the way we punish that crime today. And if you're not careful, you find yourself saying, well, why would God inflict that kind of punishment for that kind of... And I have to catch myself not thinking that. That's not a question I need to ask. It's not about why. God's God. He makes the rules, and it's up to man to follow them. And I think you got to be very careful about asking God, why did you do this? The other couple, a few more thoughts that I want you to think about as we enter into this, some things I had put in my notes, is we have an obligation to see that no one suffers financial loss through our dishonesty, irresponsible actions, or indifferent attitude. These laws imply that when humans are in contact with one another, invariably there will be a conflict. As such, an equitable method of resolving property disputes is essential for society to function. Property rights are real. Israel was never a communal society. The land and its cattle did not belong to the people. They belonged to individual Israelites. Property is and was never on par with human life. Respect for the truth is a most precious possession. God hates the perversion of justice. Serving God demands that we give humane and compassionate treatment, even to those that we might deem as subordinate to ourselves. The Lord must be our only God. And as I was looking through these verses, and as I was looking through these rules, and we'll go through them in just a moment, those were some of the thoughts that struck me, and some of the thoughts of some of the commentators that I had read that struck me. That just some of the things that we can think about as we go through these laws. So let's look at the first few verses here, and then we'll stop and make a few comments. Now these are the judgments which ye shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years. In the seventh, he shall go free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be the master's, and he shall go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go free, I'll go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. If a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as male slaves do. If she does not please her master, she who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He has no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. If he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of the daughters. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, her marriage rights. And if he does not do these things for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. Kind of interesting. You can't help but be struck somewhat by the irony of the first thing that is dealt with here is the idea of slaves and servants. For a people that had just come out of the land of Egypt and had served as slaves and servants for a long period of time. I don't know if there's any significance to that, but it certainly strikes you as that's one of the first things that you see dealt with in these verses. So the idea of a male slave and a female slave and how a male slave was to be treated versus the way a female slave was to be treated. A male slave, he would come in, he'd serve 6 years, and the seventh year he'd go free. If he came in with a wife, he could leave with a wife. If the master had given him a wife and born children, then he could still go out free. But the wife and the children were to remain with the master. If the servant didn't want to do that, then he could tell the master, no, I want to stay. I love my wife. I love my children. And the master would take an awl and put a hole in his ear, is basically what you get here. Now, the difference with that and a daughter or a female was that there's no indication that she got to go free after 6 years. Matter of fact, it seems that that was very different. The only time she would get to go free is if she was failed to be provided for by the man that had betrothed her or betrothed her to his son. If the food and the clothing and the marriage rites were not provided. One may ask, well, why the difference? And, you know, we're not told why the difference. We can look at some of that and maybe make some guesses. Men went out and worked in the fields and easier maybe perhaps to make a living than a woman during this time. Perhaps maybe one reason that was put forth in some of the things I read. Well, we're just not told. And as I was saying before, we're told a lot of the what's, but we're not always told the why's. And that's kind of the gist of that as I look at these rules. So any questions about the idea of slaves or servants and the rules regarding them? If not, if we pick up, the next section deals mostly with the idea of personal injury situations. And let's read a few of those verses. They're in verse 12. "Who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I'll appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die." I'm going to stop right there. The idea of life for life, and we see that here. Verse 13 gives you an indication of more of an accidental death to me. And it makes reference to, "I'll appoint for you a place that he may flee." Anybody got an idea of where that place that he may flee? I think that is a reference to a city of refuge. And if you remember the story, after they come into the land of Canaan, God will appoint three cities of refuge on the east side of the Jordan, three on the west side of the Jordan, so that if somebody gets in a situation like this where they kill someone, they can flee to that city of refuge where the avenger of blood cannot execute judgment against them. So definitely a little difference between premeditated murder and an accidental killing. Moving on there in verse 15, "He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death. And he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." So let's deal with a couple of, and we dealt a little bit with this on Sunday, the idea of striking a parent or cursing a parent. And our court system today certainly doesn't impose that type of a penalty for those crimes. But it gives you an idea of how God feels about that relationship and how he feels a child is to treat a parent. And we talked a little bit about that on Sunday as well. And then the idea in between there of kidnapping. And I had to admit, you know, one of those verses I really didn't remember until I reread it studying for this lesson. And it kind of struck me when I read that. It's like, wow, kidnapping bore the penalty of death. And how our society looks at that today. I mean, it's punishable, and sometimes people get several years for that. But never is it contemplated in any of our court systems that I'm aware of that strict of a penalty for that type of crime. But God viewed it that way. And it's just something to take note of. Questions or comments on any of these up and through about verse 17? Okay, let's move on to verse 18. "If men contend with each other, and one strikes another with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for his loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. And if a man beats a male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property." So the idea of two men fighting one strikes the other with his hand, a rock, or something so that he's injured. And if the man doesn't die, he's confined to bed for a period of time. After that period of time, he rises and once again is able to resume life, it appears, somewhat normally. Then the man was acquitted, but he was to basically provide for that man's needs. And just the principle there, and we, one of those comments that I made as we entered into the study, the principle there of being responsible for your actions. And boy, has our society today lost that concept. You don't have to look very far to find people that just don't want to bear any responsibility whatsoever for their actions. And as Christians, that's not the way we are to be. I don't think that's, if you look at these laws that God has set down from the beginning here and how he expected individuals to treat one another and deal with one another, he expected people to be held accountable for their actions. The idea that while this man was confined to bed until he could regain a normal life and provide for himself, that man was responsible for what he had done. And that's just something that I think our society has lost sight of today. It's not something as common as what it once was. And if the idea there, and then the last couple verses that we read, of it being different for a slave. And if you beat a slave and the slave died, there was punishment. Because there in verse 20 it says, he shall surely be punished, but it doesn't give us any indication what that punishment was. And then it's that verse 21, if they remained alive for a day or two, then there was no punishment. Once again, I don't know why the difference, but I can tell you this, that in this day and time where somebody would have invested time, money into a slave, that was property, and to lose one, even if it was as a result of your own actions, would have been something that would have been detrimental to that man's estate. That would be a service that he would no longer have. And the money associated with that slave, he would have lost. So, something to keep in mind there. Questions or comments about any of that? Yeah, there's no indication here of anything that would cause someone not to be responsible that I can see in these verses. That's certainly true. So moving on, we get to verse 22. And I'm going to read those couple verses and then we'll come back and talk about it. It said, if men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judge is determined. And if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So, the idea of a pregnant woman somehow interfering or coming upon two men fighting, perhaps one's her husband, it seems, and tries to break up that fight, and she's injured. She's injured to the point that she gives birth prematurely. It says, yet no harm follows. Then he's punished basically according to what the woman's husband imposes on him. But if harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and so forth. So, there are those that look at this verse and say, yea, verily, there you have it. Here's God defending the right of an unborn fetus. And then you've got those that absolutely say, no, that's not what that verse is saying at all. That it doesn't specify who the harm is coming to. So, as I thought about that, and I tried to make sense of opposing views on this verse, this is kind of where what I came to, and when I'm done, you guys can tell me where I'm wrong, because I'm not convinced I'm 100% right on this. The idea of injury occurring, we've already kind of seen that dealt with in verses 12 through 14 and 18 and 19. And granted, it's talking about men there, it's not dealing with a pregnant woman, but the idea of injury occurring during a fight or a confrontation has kind of already been dealt with. So you say, well, what makes this situation different? Well, what makes this situation different is apparently the woman's pregnant. So, with that in mind, you say, well, if you read this in light of it's talking about the baby, then, okay, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. How many babies do you know that are born with teeth? Well, I thought, well, I don't know of any. But I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm not supposed to take that super literal. Possibly I can. But maybe it's not just talking about the baby. Maybe it's talking about the mother and or the baby. And as I thought about it more and more, that's kind of where I settled in on, is that I don't want to say it's just talking about the mother, because if it's just talking about the mother, it seems like we've already kind of dealt with those situations back in the other earlier verses that we had. And if it's talking about only the baby, then, you know, mate, you know, it's, I have to take that tooth for tooth literal. And like I said, I don't want to make too much of that, because maybe that's just a little bit of trying to be an all-inclusive list. But God don't make mistakes. So I throw that out. Anybody that's got an opposing view or a differing view or some kind of comment you want to make along those lines, because I've heard this verse used to defend the idea of God is against abortion. I honestly, you know, I absolutely believe God's against abortion. The question is, does this verse support that? And so I'll throw it open for any question or comment. Come on, I gave my opinion. That's kind of, like I said, that's kind of where I settled in on it. But, you know, it is a very hotly contested verse. And like I said, the more you read about it, the more you see how hotly. And obviously you see why in our society today, because there are those that absolutely don't want this verse to teach God's opposition to abortion, because they want that choice. But as I looked at it, and I looked at it in context of what rules have already been put there, there's obviously something special about this woman being pregnant, was the conclusion that I came to. And the idea that the harm that's coming appears probably to me to be to either party. Any other comments about that before we move on? If not, verse 26 and 27, if a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. If he knocks out a tooth from the male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth. So here we see that those servants do have some, the rights, and the injury to an eye or to a tooth would be enough to allow that servant to go free. And then the last section of this chapter kind of deals with animal control laws, is the way it's written in my Bible, at least the heading in the Bible. And the idea I want you to look at as we read through these verses is the idea of having knowledge of what an animal will do and how that changes the situation. Verse 28, if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, then the ox shall surely be stoned and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. But if the ox tended to thrust with his horns in times past and has been made known to his owner and he has not kept it confined so that it has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned and its owner shall be put to death. If there is imposed on him a sum of money, then he shall pay to redeem his life, whatever is imposed. Whether it is gored a son or gored a daughter, according to this judgment, it shall be done to him. If the ox gores a male or female servant, he shall give to their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. If a man opens a pit, or if a man digs a pit and does not cover it, the ox or the donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make it good. He shall give money for their owner, the dead animal shall be his. If one man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then he shall sell the live ox and divide the money from it, and the dead ox shall be also divided. Or if it was known that the ox tended to thrust in times past, and the owner had not kept it confined, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall be his own. So the idea is you have an ox, and that ox causes injury. It gores another person, and that person dies. And if that happened, the owner was to acquit it, but the ox was to be put to death. The difference being what I had kind of clued you into before, the knowledge of that owner, and whether or not, based on that knowledge, that owner had done anything to keep that event from happening. If that ox had known to have done those type of things in the past and the owner didn't do anything about it, then the penalty was much more severe and to the point of imposing death, although the idea that he could be redeemed by some price that was imposed, he could redeem his life, is there. And once again, it goes back to that idea of personal responsibility and being responsible not only for your own actions, but for the actions of those things that you own. And just something for us to be aware of today. Most of us don't have an ox, but some of us may have dogs. And some of those dogs may tend to bite or injure other people. I would think in light of the principles being laid down there, we've got a special responsibility when it comes to that particular animal. Idea once again of the penalty being somewhat different if the individual that was gored was a servant. It was a price that you could pay. 30 shekels was the price that was to be paid to the owner. There in verse 33, the whole same idea of digging a pit and just carelessly leaving it uncovered and the responsibility you bore for that. And then it finishes up there with the idea of, you know, an ox hurting another animal, another ox, and once again, the knowledge of whether or not that animal had tended to do that in times past figures into what penalty was to be paid. So as we look here at those verses and really chapter 21, does anybody have any questions or comments about any of those laws before we move on and try to get a little bit into chapter 22 tonight? Mark. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was one thought that came to me over and over again is the sense of responsibility that we are to bear.
A little bit of a reality check. we've got almost 2 million people now floating around the wilderness, the desert.
Yep.
Who knows how many thousands of acres are taken up? And we've got all these rules and stuff coming in. We're going to need a lot of judges to take care of this because people are not going to be honest.
Right.
And we'll see that later on when they get to the mountain, what happens when they're left alone for 40
right.
days. We're not talking, we're not dealing exclusively with a bunch of pristine ne'er-do-wells, pardon the expression, who are just looking out for their neighbor. So judicial expediency is going to be, be tough.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to, you know, we were talking a little bit about when the father-in-law comes to visit Moses, and they're in verse in chapter 18, and basically, you know, they set up.
Before the rules came in.
Right. Even then, judging this people was a
your
massive job.
Ox scored you. It's not my fault.
Right.
You tempted them, so I can see that.
And that's something that's worth, you know, discussing just a little bit, is the idea of, and we saw it even in chapter 20, where verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And the idea, and I think I've got it here in my notes, I'm not probably going to get to it tonight, but the idea of a man's word and what a man's word is supposed to say about him. And reminded of the passage in the New Scripture, let your yea be yea and your nay, yea, nay. And the idea of when I tell you something, you should be able to depend on that. And it should never be said of any Christian, well, yeah, you can't really depend on him. If he tells you something, he may not follow through. And that idea of honesty and being responsible for your actions, as we've already said, is throughout this. And it's a reminder to all of us that we're to be people of integrity. And I don't know a better way to put it. Just when people speak of us, when something's said about us, they can say, well, you know, they have integrity. Everything they've ever told me has been true. If they told me they were going to do something, they followed through. If they told me something happened or didn't happen, then I absolutely believe them. And really, there's not a lot of better compliment that can be paid to you by the people of the world than to say that of you, I don't think. And that's you know, when I think about that, is that person's a person of integrity. And whatever they tell you, you can take to the bank, basically. Other questions or comments about chapter 21 before we move on? You know, it's interesting, like I said, people don't want those Ten Commandments displayed in any kind of public building anymore. But yet, courthouses or any place like that, yet the laws, so many of the laws that we have today have their very foundation either in the Ten Commandments or some of the things that we've talked about tonight. They came from God. The principles that we use to govern ourselves today, the vast majority of them are principles that God laid down years ago in the way that we're to deal with one another. And just something to think about. Well, I think I've just about talked myself out of time. So we're just going to stop there, and we'll start with chapter 22.